This week on Writers, Inc.
When I tell writers go to a conference, what you're doing is you're kind of baiting hooks. You are setting those traps, if you will, or baiting hooks so that when things align, you're ready. I had to have the book written. I had to establish the relationships with the people at the conference so I would get invited to the conference, because this was early in my career. Before my career, really. I had to lay the groundwork, practice my pitch so that that editor liked me. And then when it all aligned and I got this agent Robin and I see things alike, and she really is good about, you know, recognizing what's good and bad in craft. So we were lucky that I was fortunate to find her.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
Patrick O'Donnell.
J.P. Reinflush.
The artist formerly known as Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. I went to the movies this weekend. I went to an actual movie theater and I saw Oppenheimer. All 12 hours of it, or however long it was.
It's quite an investment of time.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. Like, I was more interested in how he was going to tell this story because I read the book that it's based on. I think it's called The American Prometheus. Great book. But there's really not a whole lot of action in that book. And, you know, like, when I think of Christopher Nolan, I think action. So I was just curious on how he was going to tell this story. And, like, the way that he wrote this script and the way he filmed it and jumping back and forth between timelines and this and that, like, it was just so incredibly well done. I mean, just a phenomenal piece of storytelling. If I had any complaints, and I've read some stuff about this since, it was the noise level, because Christopher Nolan, I guess he does his own mix, and he refuses to allow actors to go back and re-record dialogue, you know, which is a fairly standard practice. So normally they shoot a scene, you know, if something is difficult to hear, you know, because the microphones don't pick it up or whatever, they go back and they have the actor re-record that. He refuses to do that. He always uses the dialogue that's captured on set. And to make that worse, he uses IMAX cameras for a lot of these movies that he films, and they're extremely loud. So in order to compensate for that, you know, they crank up the music. Like, he does his own mix. So, like, the music bed is really loud. The audio is very difficult to hear. So yeah, that's probably my only complaint. But, like, it, you know, even if you don't care about the story itself, just get in there, watch it. You know, like, it doesn't have to be at the theater or whatever, but, like, from a storytelling, from a writer perspective, you know, the way that he crafted these stories and made it interesting, it kept you completely glued to that screen right down to literally the last camera shot. You're hanging, trying to figure out, you know, what the answer to this one particular question is. It was phenomenal. Awesome. That being said, there's no way in hell I'm going to see Barbie.
No.
I'm with you, man.
What?
I just am not interested.
I'm interested, but not in the theater.
Well, the only reason I would even think about it is because it's clearly having some sort of cultural zeitgeist thing happening with it, right? Because everyone's talking about it, raving about it. Well, you know, I don't know, man. I just can't do it.
Is that really just good? Barbie. Is that good marketing, though? Like, is that really what all this is?
Yes,
I think so. I don't know if you've seen, but their marketing budget. The marketing budget for that film is actually like several hundred million dollars more than the cost of producing the film.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, they have done this, like, they've got AR stuff, augmented reality stuff everywhere, where you can hold up your phone and watch a giant Barbie walk out of a box and, you know, walk across the street or something. I mean, they've got just phenomenal marketing around.
Yeah. I don't know if it's still happening, but when I was searching on Google, if you searched Ryan Gosling, or is it Margot Robbie? I'm not sure how you pronounce her last name, but the whole Google screen would turn pink, and there was, like, pink fireworks and everything. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had that in my notes. Yeah. So the audience, if you're listening, Excellent. Just go on there and just type in Barbie movie or something on Google and just watch what happens. And I've got no clue how they even set that up. You know, like, if you think about the number of phone calls and the, you know, that have to be made to get something like that started, the programming that has to happen, it's going on worldwide. So it's not just in the US. Like, they have thought this through from start to finish from a marketing standpoint. And honestly, like, when I heard that this movie was being made, it, you know, to me, it just seems like another throwaway title, you know, like one of those things you're going to see in the theater for, you know, one or two weekends and then it goes away. And like, I'm wondering, like, without this kind of marketing, is that what would have happened to it? But, you know, kudos to that marketing team.
Well, the Lego movie, I mean, the Lego movie did really well. Yeah. Same concept. So I think that there's something there. There's like the nostalgic factor that hits a lot of millennials that now have children. I mean, I think it's a mix of a movie that has, at least by the people that I know that have seen it, has a message that they like and they want to promote. And then the marketing on top of that, and just a product that people can tangibly touch and like have a connection to. I think that just makes great fodder for this kind of thing.
Well, I was listening to Gary V's podcast and he was talking about the same thing. And the top two selling toys of all time, Barbie was number two, and Hot Wheels. Hot Wheel cars are the best selling toy of all of all time.
Wow. So I would have guessed Legos.
I wouldn't be surprised if you see a Hot Wheels movie coming out later. Yeah, you know, remember Cars? Disney had Cars.
There is. They call it Fast and Furious.
They'll meld the two. They'll mix the two of them together.
Yeah. I'm definitely interested in seeing Barbie though, just because I've seen all the stuff that they've been promoting with their little Ken Sentials and Kenuff and all the gender reversal role stereotype stuff. So I'm definitely going to see it. I just don't want to see it on the big screen.
I think I'd rather have my fingernails removed one at a time than a Barbie movie.
I would also rather have JD's fingernails removed one at a time.
I think we need to have a watch party in live stream as well. For the future. All comment on it together. I think that's a thing that needs to happen.
Yeah.
All right, JP, what's in the actual real news?
Okay, well, get ready for that booze. Kickstarter is introducing their AI policy. So Kickstarter has developed a policy regarding projects that incorporate or build artificial intelligence, set to go into effect August 29th. This step follows discussions with creators, backers, platform leaders, staff members, aiming to establish a framework and a guide. Policy doesn't prohibit the use of AI in projects, but it requires that projects funded via Kickstarter involve human creative input and ensure proper credit and permission for any artist's work that is used. So this was sent to me by Kevin, I think it's a really interesting stance. So what are your guys' thoughts on that sort of creativity crowdfunding intermixed with AI?
You know, I honestly put zero thought into it until I saw this story, and then I started trying to figure out like how could you use AI for Kickstarter, and then it brought me back to one of the initial demos where somebody created a website using AI in, you know, like a matter of seconds, which I'm guessing is what they're getting at, right? Like somebody could literally come up with, you know, just some random idea. They could use AI to generate their entire Kickstarter campaign and just throw it up there. And frankly, you could take that one step further and you could probably use AI to generate the ideas and just start, you know, basically automate it, where it generates an idea, creates the websites, gets them posted on Kickstarter, you know, upload 1,000 of them in a day. If one of them generates money for you, that's fantastic. The other 999 can vanish and nobody cares. I'm guessing that's what they're trying to eliminate.
Yeah, that's the sort of format that people are using when it comes to books. They're generating like, you know, here's 1,000 books that are really just vague outlines. And they do it like on the hour. I think what I liked about this story, and what I think is kind of leaning in on is what is really needed when it comes to AI is less litigation and regulation and more policy. And I'm almost never an advocate for policy, but when it comes to this stuff, like the individual channels, Kickstarter, the retailers like Apple and Amazon and others who take books and other content, you know, all these entities, they're going to have to be the ones who decide how AI plays any role in what they're doing. And I think Kickstarter is really off to the right start because they're saying, look, we're not going to disallow it, but we are going to require human interaction with this. You know, there has to be human brains and minds working on this. And here are some other little guidelines. I think that's the right approach. And I think that's what's going to help us avoid, you know, inadvertently creating a crap storm later by pushing a bunch of copyright rules and laws that were more band-aids than actual solutions.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I like that they have a human team reviewing too, because for writers, you know, with places like Grammarly announcing that they're using AI. So if I've used Grammarly, so I need to disclose, hey, I've used Grammarly, which uses AI. And, you know, hopefully having a human team behind that will be like, that's fine, right? Like, that's not an issue. So it is a bit of a slippery slope, though, with writers. Like,
yeah. I read it and it was clear as mud to me. You know, how are you going to identify this? How are you going to police it? Yeah, you know, I'm just looking at this and I'm like, no. I mean, obviously, you know, they have to say it and I understand why they are saying it. But actually identifying people doing this, and to what you just said, Christine, to what degree?
Yeah.
So good luck.
That's the point, though. They're not going to have to police it. That's the whole point of making this policy. It what it does is it creates an honor system, and we all know people are going to take advantage
absolutely
of that. But what it also does is give them leverage when they discover someone did do something that violated the policy. Then they can take action. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like when you know, Starbucks sends a cease and desist letter to somebody for calling their drink a Frappuccino. Like, they may or may not intend to actually sue anybody over that, but they have to establish that they made the effort, right? It's the same sort of thing. They have, the Kickstarter and these other companies are basically just outlining, like, here are the rules. You must, obey them, abide by them. And there's going to be penalties if you don't. And now they're covered. Yeah. If they don't catch it, that just means you did really well, right? Well,
this is how they'll catch it. They're going to watch people. You know, if an account is uploading 100 new Kickstarters a day, they're going to jump out. There's going to be algorithms. The funny thing is, they're probably going to use some form of AI to actually catch the AI, you know, populating the system. And I think Kevin's right. I think we're going to see a lot of this. I wouldn't be surprised if something like iTunes comes out with something next, because how long is it, you know, before we start hearing songs that are, you know, 100% generated by AI? And then upload it to iTunes, put on sale for 99 cents each, you know, 1,000 of those every day too. So everybody that's basically involved in peddling content is going to find some way to put a screen door on the front door. Mm-hmm. Nice big bouncer.
I didn't know you could still buy songs on iTunes like the old days. I mean, everything is subscription, it seems like.
Yeah, it's the button right next to your 8-track player.
And my hi-fi.
Yeah.
All right. Next two news are not AI. So we did it. We got through it. Next one. Judge finds revived Amazon ebook monopoly suit should proceed. So a New York magistrate judge has suggested a second dismissal of a class action lawsuit accusing the Big Five publishers and Amazon of colluding to fix ebook prices. However, the judge found that monopolization claims against Amazon should proceed. So ultimately, the judge found no evidence of coordination or conspiracy among the Big Five publishers or between the publishers and Amazon, leading to the recommendations to dismiss that case against the publishers. The judge report and recommendation now move to the district court. So this is one of those things that I think has been first filed January 2021. This is something that you may or may not have heard of, but regardless, is still interesting to know.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this case. Kevin, are you familiar at all with this?
I mean, I remember when this came up. I mean, it was the accusation of price fixing. I mean, it was at the heart of a whole bunch of different, I don't know, I wouldn't call them decisions. It was sort of like, okay, we're going to put a moratorium on this and we're going to lock some things down. But yeah, I mean, I have a vague memory of it. It kind of didn't go anywhere fast, I think.
I sort of remember them having an issue like way before that, like 2014, 2015, where the big publishers got together and said, this is going to be the minimum amount we're going to charge for ebooks, or Amazon forced that on them. It was something along those lines, but that's why the traditional Apple published books have a
certain threshold. Yeah, I mean, that targeted Amazon, but it was the result of Apple getting into books. And they did a whole basically, Apple kind of leveraged things in such a way that, you know, what it did was break it open so that the Big Five had the right to determine this is the price and you can't go below that price. because Amazon has a long history of underselling the MSRP on everything, and kind of treating it all as loss leader to get people into programs like Kindle Unlimited and Amazon Prime and et cetera, where they actually make their real money. Those subscriptions that you pay every year that keep going up every year, like I think it's like $120 a year now. It started like $89 a year for Amazon Prime. But that's where they're making tons of recurring income. So selling this book from Hachette for $5 versus the $21 it would normally sell for, that was a loss leader for them. So this all threw that out and forced Amazon to allow them to set the price, and Amazon was no longer able to adjust it.
I guess if I have any concern here, it's, you know, like right now there seems to be set levels for everybody's pricing, and you know, indie authors, for whatever reason, they tend to price low. I don't think they all should. I think a lot of them should price a lot higher than they really do. But we're forced to.
A lot of time. I mean, there's a limit on where how much you can price. You can, $9.99 is the upper limit on Amazon.
Right.
But other platforms follow suit. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, what I'm concerned with is I don't know where the medium price is. I'm guessing it's around $6. Probably the average across the board. I would hate to see something get rolled out that causes that average to drop lower. I think indies can price wherever they want. I totally understand why a lot of them go lower. I'm in a fortunate position where I've got traditionally published books that can't go below $9. So that means that when I indie publish a title, I can put those way up at $9 because it's on par and that's what my customers expect. But as soon as you set a certain price, if your customers expect $4 out of you, then that is your price. That from the customer's standpoint, you're kind of stuck. Right. And I would hate to see indie authors be forced to even go lower, because if that average drops from, let's say if it's at $6 and it drops to $4 and indies are pricing between 99 cents and $3, they might have to go lower. Amazon may have to change their bottom threshold and say, okay, 50 cents is now acceptable. All of a sudden everything drops lower for everybody. And I could see that happening in something like this.
Last bit of news. Another case. So this one is the judgment phase of the Internet Archive copyright case, which appears to be imminent. So over 4 months since a federal judge declared the Internet Archive guilty of copyright infringement for its library book scanning and lending program, the litigation progress is finally moving towards the judgment phase. So the plaintiff publishers are seeking damages and injunctive relief, including the removal of potentially infringing scans. Meanwhile, the Internet Archive's lawyers have countered the statutory damages should be reduced under Section 504 of the Copyright Act. So I know this was something that I think we talked about a couple months ago, but it seems like this is, again, moving forward in the slow judicial news.
Yeah, and this is one of those websites that just needs to go away, right? They've got their hands in everybody's pocket, and they're just taking advantage of a situation. And, it's getting resolved. It's just, like you said, taking very, very long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to add.
I think any author who's got books in that,
that's fair.
Any author who's got books in that archive, they want to see this go away, right? I mean, there's a system for libraries. There's a system for lending from libraries. Yep. We're all compensated through that system. Yeah. They're trying to circumvent it. They deserve to get whatever happens to them. So good riddance.
If it's sort of ironic, that, this is basically forcing, a new look at copyright. I just interviewed somebody who was telling me like the last major copyright overhaul was in 1976.
Wow.
And we've had sort of patches and little things change here and there, but no major revision, no look back to see, and things, I don't know if you noticed, but things have changed a little since 1976 in terms of, books and movies and music and all of that. We have entirely new means of distribution that were never even conceived of at that time. AI coming on the scene is definitely impacting copyright. So, I think right now we're in this like powder keg moment where, copyright and IP law, I think they're going to have to get a major overhaul for the first time in almost 50 years.
Yeah, it's coming for sure. I mean, when I worked on the Dracula prequel for the Stoker family, Dracula is in public domain, and it really didn't have to be. If the family would have handled the copyright properly. There's a lot of things that could be done to keep that kind of thing from happening, and they didn't do it. And it's, as far as I know, it's the second best selling book in the world, right behind the Bible. And you know that the family basically doesn't profit from that anymore. So you know, if you're an author, you've got books out there, you're making, you know, money, little money, a lot of money, it doesn't really matter. You know, like Bram Stoker wasn't making money as an author, not really, not before he died. So definitely sit down with an attorney at some point, take a look at your products, make sure your copyrights are set up properly. There's a lot of ways to organize that to make sure you're safe.
This episode is brought to you by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. AutoCrit takes you far above standard grammar checking or cookie cutter guidance. Instead, it's like having an experienced editor in your genre watching over your shoulder to help you deliver great writing that keeps your audience trapped in the story. You can even compare your writing style to more than 100 best-selling authors right down to the word level, so you can see what the best in the business do to keep their storytelling clean, clear, and crisp. Listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can now take advantage of lifetime membership for one single fee. That's right, no renewal fees.
Hi, this is J.D. Barker. I've used AutoCrit for years, and not only has it improved my writing, but it's been a crucial tool with aspiring authors that I've mentored. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just beginning, it'll help you find your weak spots and weed them out. Give it a shot with your latest project. Trust me, your editor will thank you.
Head to AutoCrit.com/JD to get your lifetime membership. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
All right, so JD, who's up this week?
This week we've got Mark Cameron. He's a retired chief deputy U.S. Marshal turned author. He not only writes his own thrillers, but he's writing in the Tom Clancy universe with Jack Ryan. So here he is, Mark Cameron.
Mark Cameron, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Patrick.
You know, I'm going to bounce around a little bit here as far as chronology goes, because that's how I think. But what was the moment you realized that writing was a realistic, sustainable income for you? Was there like a light bulb moment? You remember where you were, or what you were doing?
Well, I mean, income.
Yeah.
I mean, I always wanted to be a writer, but the first time we made any money, it was like $700. And my wife had the check in her hand when I got home, and I'd spent like 20 years getting rejection letters and, you know, submitting and rejecting. And she met me and, you know, she's been so patient with me sitting, you know, in the other room typing. And, you know, I started on a Smith Corona electric typewriter. So it took a long time to edit and send things off. And I remember she met me at the door with a rolled up magazine and kind of swatted me on the butt and said, "This is great. Now go write us a fridge. We need a new fridge," you know, so really not sustainable. I'm not discounting a $700 check, but it wasn't enough to retire. But I guess probably about 2 years before I retired from the United States Marshal Service, I started to see an upward trajectory. So maybe about 1.5 Jericho Quinn novels in. Okay. And it wasn't enough at the time, but it was an upward trajectory. And that's what I was looking for, was building. And I have a very, very good agent, Robin Rue with Writer's House. And she gave me some good advice. And then Kensington, who bought my initial books and still publishes the Jerichos and the Arliss Cutters, they do a good job of building, have done a very good job of building me as a writer.
So what was the good advice that you were given?
Oh, your front list sells your back list. In other words, the best way you can advertise a book is to write another book. So if you write another book, especially in series like I do, when I write another book, I always notice a bump in sales, because you reach a new audience, and then those people, if they like that book, they'll go back and read the earlier ones. And especially now with Audible and electronic editions that are always out there. There's no, you know, I mean, my books are in print as well, but it's not hard for somebody when they pick up an Arliss Cutter novel or a Jericho novel or one of the Clancy novels and go, "Oh, I enjoyed this. I'll go back and see what else Mark Cameron's written." So that was something that Robin told me early on when I was saying, "Well, we got to figure out how to promote this." And she said, "Write another book. That's the best one.
So do you remember how that relationship started? How did you get Robin for your agent? That seems to be like the toughest nut to crack. You know, what's your suggestion for that? Your advice?
No, I'm a big proponent of conferences. You know how we say, when you say, how you doing? I say, better than I deserve. Well, this is an illustration of what I mean. I pitched back in the mid 2000s, early 2000s, at a conference in Helena, Montana for Western Writers, called Western Writers of America. And I'd written not a old time Louis L'Amour style Western, but a Western set in 1910. So starting to turn, you know, just after the turn of the century. So we had new guns come, you know, the 1911 was actually in play in 1910, just, you know, Browning's prototypes and all that. So it's kind of a fun time. So I was a horseshoer and part-time cowboy and mounted policeman, and then got on with the marshals. So I thought I could write a Western because of that vernacular. I could speak the language, you know?
Right.
I pitched this book to a couple of editors and a couple of agents in Helena at this conference. It was a smaller conference than Thriller Fest. There was probably maybe 300 or 400 people there. Still a good sized conference.
Yeah.
And some big time editors and agents. And I pitched to a editor from Kensington, a lady named really, really nice lady. And I dressed up in my hat and, you know, I was like I normally dress. And I practiced and practiced in front of the mirror, which I always tell people they need to do. Get that elevator pitch down, get the log line. If you can't boil down what your book's about in a sentence or two, then you don't have a good concept of what your book's about in order to pitch it. Okay. So I practiced that. I made my pitch. She requested three chapters. I talked to several people, and a couple of people requested chapters, but not, I could tell they were not as interested. They were just, didn't want the big guy with a mustache and hat mad at him, you know? And so she went back about, I don't know, a month later, maybe 6 weeks later, I got a call from her, and they wanted to publish my book, but they needed me to do some ghostwriting first for an established author, because she couldn't get my book in the publication line. At this point, yeah. I didn't have an agent, and I didn't have her signed contract. So she sent me a bunch of the books for this other author so I could read the past ones. And then I called back and I said to the Kensington's main number, and I said, hey, this is Mark. I'm supposed to talk to so-and-so. And they said, well, she doesn't work anymore. I said, well, you know, okay, but I'm supposed to ghostwrite these books. And they said, that's between you and her. And that was it. I was
okay.
I was orphaned. So I was nearly in tears. I mean, here I was. I had such a close thing. I was getting ready to start this writing career that I really wanted. And out of the blue, about 2 days later, I got an email from Robin Rue with Writer's House. Now, Writer's House is a phenomenal agency. They represent Ken Follett, Neil Gaiman. I mean, big
yeah, name. Absolutely.
And and it was very cordial but short email. My name is Robin Rue. I got your pages from this editor, and I really would like to represent you. I think you have potential. You may Google me and find out, you know, search me and see what I am, but please contact me such and such. So I was like, the long answer to your simple question is, I submitted to an editor, and that editor gave them to an agent, and the agent called me, and she's been my agent for 20 years.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate. And you know, I say that I was lucky, but when I tell writers go to a conference, what you're doing is you're kind of baiting hooks. You are setting those traps, if you will, or baiting hooks so that when things align, you're ready. I had to have the book written. I had to establish the relationships with the people at the conference, so I would get invited to the conference, because this was early in my career. Before my career, really. I had to lay the groundwork, practice my pitch so that editor liked me. And then when it all aligned and I got this agent, Robin and I
see things alike when it comes to, you know, what a book should be and what would be. Because I don't want to be the kind of writer that's only remembered because I was a deputy U.S. Marshal or some kind of quote unquote action guy. Yeah. I want people to read my books because they're entertaining books and then go, oh, he was a deputy U.S. Marshal. He knows what he's talking about. Not the other way around necessarily, because I like the craft. And she really is good about, you know, recognizing what's good and bad in craft. So we were lucky that I was fortunate to find her and find the kind of agent. Cause I've been around many, many writers over the last, you know, 15 years, 20 years. And they go through, you know, people that are new are always wanting an agent, get an agent. I got to get an agent. It is difficult. And they get so focused on that, that they'll get an agent that doesn't fit them necessarily because they have a contract. And if they got a contract, they can get an agent. And so they go through two or three. So I've been very fortunate to find a really, really talented agent that's probably, no exaggeration, probably doubled my income in writing of what I would have if I did not have an agent.
Wow.
And is just, I mean, she's a friend. And when we go to New York, we have dinner with her and my editor. And these are old time, I'm dating us all, but these are old time literary people from back in the day when it was not quite as dog eat dog as it is now. So it's very fun for me to go and talk to them.
Gotcha. Now, in your previous life, you were in law enforcement. You started out in a small town in Texas and you wound up in the Marshals. Why don't we start out with, you know, what is the role of the Marshals? Sometimes, you know, you see people getting it wrong in books and movies and et cetera. You know, why don't you kind of what their mission is?
Right. The beauty of the Marshal Service for a writer is that if you look at the credentials of most federal agencies, it'll say so-and-so is a sworn special agent with, let's say, customs, duly authorized to carry firearms and make arrests pursuant to U.S. code. And then it lists off all the things that they can investigate and make arrests for. And the Secret Service is the same way. The DEA is the same way. And they have broad authority, but it is codified. And then, of course, any felony that's committed in front of them because they're a law enforcement officer, but not necessarily a peace officer in every state.
Right.
Marshals, our credentials say so-and-so is a deputy U.S. Marshal, duly sworn to carry, you know, a firearm and enforce federal law. So it's very broad. And so over the years, the Bureau, the Secret Service, everybody has sort of taken their chunk, but we've retained that authority so that if, say, Patrick O'Donnell was going to be sworn in as a special deputy U.S. Marshal, or say Patrick O'Donnell was going to go down to the Olympics in Salt Lake City when they were there, for example, we had a lot of people come in that were state and locals. You wouldn't necessarily have the authority to work in Utah. And so we would need to give you that authority federally. The agency that does that is the United States Marshal Service because we have that broad authority. So when a writer writes about a marshal helping the troopers investigate a murder, that doesn't happen very often, but it certainly could happen. And so if you write it right, but generally speaking, the Marshal Service's main job, our number one main job, is to protect the federal judiciary. It's not the sexiest part of our job. Our sexiest part of our job is hunting fugitives. And the Marshal Service does it every day of the year, 24/7, somewhere they're hunting fugitives. And we're talking tens of thousands of fugitives every year. The Marshal Service is very proud of the work they've done, that we've done in the fugitive hunting business where it comes to electronic surveillance and just boots on the ground, wearing out shoe leather, doing investigations. And so we arrest more fugitives every year than all the other federal agencies combined.
Wow.
And so that's sort of our bread and butter. That's how we get, you know, between the protecting Supreme Court justices have details, protective details after every time they leave the Capitol Beltway made up of U.S. Marshals, and the Supreme Court police generally protect them inside the Capitol Beltway. Mm-hmm.
And then we also protect federal judges and do protective investigations for federal judges when they're threatened anywhere, you know, in the United States. For instance, I was assigned and then put up protective details, but only when there's a credible threat. They don't have protection like the Secret Service, say, protects the president or the vice president or, what, or whatever. But if there's a credible threat, then, for instance, after the first World Trade Center bombing, remember when Ramzi Youssef, they drove that truck underneath and they did some damage to the tower, but it didn't bring it down. The judges that were hearing that case got protection. And so I rotated in as a younger deputy and was just on a protective detail, as you would see the Secret Service or diplomatic security. So we do that. We also handle federal prisoners and junior deputies. When you first come on, you're usually all excited about doing fugitives and a junior deputy. We affectionately call them pods. They're just plain old deputies. They don't have any expertise yet. So our early deputies spend a lot of time in court. They're producing prisoners for the judge and keeping that prisoner secure and safe. And so it can be kind of disheartening. Every agency, every department has its downside. And so when somebody says, why should I join your agency instead of this agency? Well, in the Secret Service, great agency. I've got many friends in the Secret Service. They have to travel all the time.
Yep.
There's a lot of post standing when you're a newer agent. There's a lot of, but they do some cool stuff and they get a great budget because they're protecting our commander in chief. So you have to decide. In the FBI, for instance, great budget. They have in Alaska, for instance, the FBI has more admin staff than we have deputies. So they've got a lot of folks, but they have a ton of paperwork and they're constantly being audited by their own people. Inspectors come in and look at them and they're doing case checks and case files. And that's good. That's the way it needs to be. But there is a ton of paperwork. After an arrest, there's a ton of paperwork. After surveillance, there's a ton of paperwork. In the Marshal Service, we sit in court. That's the bad part. But when we go out and make an arrest, our USM 11 might be four lines long.
That's beautiful.
Oh. And it's just, it reminds me of the old Texas Ranger, the old Texas Ranger story about the guy that went down and got in a gunfight with a, Billy Bob or whatever. And he sent a report back to his Ranger captain and said, Billy Bob so-and-so robbed the bank and I engaged him in gunfire and killed him in the report. And the captain said, or the sergeant, whoever it is, captain said, you got to give me more detail. And so the Ranger wrote back, well, Billy Bob, Rob said bank, I engaged him in gunfire, killed him dead, weather cloudy. And so, and I, we want our deputies to give, and being a writer, I was kind of known as a red pen chief. I wanted my deputies to write good reports, but just the facts. I just wanted the facts and we didn't have to, it's just that kind of job. So really quickly, we do prisoner operations, we do judicial protection and protective investigations, we do fugitive operations, we have a special operations group, which is like a SWAT team, like that we use for, they're based in Louisiana, and there's some full-time teams and there's some people that respond from the districts to handle tactical issues for the Marshal Service, and the Attorney General can deploy them wherever. And then we also handle a witness security program, which, we're not really allowed to talk about because of, the security of it and the secrecy of it, but it keeps people safe and allows, it really goes hand in glove with the protection of the judiciary, because what we want is we want judges to be able to be impartial and we want witnesses to be able to testify without fear of some sort of, blowback. So, and we've, over the course of the history of the witness security program, a witness protection program, we call it witness security. The media usually calls it witness protection program, but we call it WITSEC. And over that course of that time, we've not lost a single witness that stayed on the program. There's been some that have thumbed their nose at the rules and gone back to their normal life and, okay, God be with you, go on. And some of them have not made it very long, but when they follow our rules, they do well.
So those are the general things that we do.
Sure.
Because we have such a broad authority, the Attorney General can send us anywhere he or she wants to. So I've been to I was deployed to the Los Angeles riots after the Rodney King verdict. I was deployed to Florida after Hurricane Andrew in 91. They sent about 300 deputy marshals there to just help with civilian law enforcement. Because they're all the policemen's houses were blown over. So,
right.
I've had friends go to the Virgin Islands and track down fugitives after a prison was blown down, coal miner strikes. In my opinion, that's what made the Marshal Service so interesting for me as a young deputy. And what makes it interesting to me to write about in the Arliss Cutter novels is that you could go to work as a young deputy in the morning and think you were going to be heading on a special assignment to work a court detail with the Mexican mafia in California. And halfway to work, you get a call that says, no, we've got this thing in Mississippi that we really need to go to. And then you're almost there. And then, nope, there's a motorcycle gang trial or a threat on a judge. And I've been batted back and forth as many as three times in a day, not knowing where I was going to go and ending up in New York City protecting the foreign minister of China. So
wow.
I like that. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Now, when you were still in law enforcement, you never stopped writing, correct?
No, correct.
You'd kept on writing through all of this. And one thing that I've noticed looking at reviews and listening to people talk about all of your work, including the Tom Clancy stuff, is, you hear things like thriller, page turner, can't put it down, that kind of thing. I hear that from, it's kind of a painting with a broad brush, but as a writer, what kind of advice would you give to a fellow writer, maybe a less experienced writer that's trying to break in and trying to get that feel, trying to write real page turners and, edgier seat kind of like thrills? What's some of the stuff that you would suggest to them to kind of like up their games a bit?
Well, a couple of things that I work on personally, that you just got to write the story first, and then you can go back and edit it and, tweak it. And I might write three pages before I get into the first line, before I get into the line that I know is going to be the hook. Now, I needed to write those first several pages, maybe even a chapter, but I needed to write all those to get to that line, but they don't end up in the book. So don't be scared to just start writing. But that I'm a real student of first lines. So I'll go into a bookstore or a library and I'll just look at writers that I like. And I don't have time to read as much as I like. I still read. I think that's very important to read. And I've been a Ken Follett fan since I was a kid. And so Ken Follett, and now, some of the contemporary writers, my contemporaries, Jack Carr and Mark Graney Nick Petrie. I like Nick Petrie's work. Some of them are more literary. Other ones are action, action, action. They're all action.
Right.
But, look at the way other writers do things. I get accused a lot. Some people angry, some people tongue in cheek of having too many cliffhangers. Well, I believe that I write a series and I try to end every, end the book so there's a satisfying ending, but then have some sort of denouement where, okay, I start the next fire, right? I light the next fuse. And people will say, back when I used to read my reviews, which I haven't in like 8 years, but back when I was looking at the reviews and writing the Jericho books, I would get an email saying, you're only leaving this cliffhanger to make me buy your next book. Well, of course I want people to buy the next book, but that's not why I do it. I do it to thrill people. And I do it to watch television, watch any show right now, and every episode, their goal is to make you click watch next show.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
To make you binge. And so my goal would be to have someone binge my books. So yes, sometimes I leave a cliffhanger, an unanswered question at the end of the books. I don't ever leave anybody hanging off the edge of the cliff, even figuratively, but there is an unanswered question because life is that way. From being in law enforcement, when you solve a case, there's another case that's half done.
Oh, absolutely.
You got to get back to, right? Or not even started. So what I want to do is make that reality of, okay, here's this serial killer that's out there that we know about.
but here's our A story. And I work on the A story with little bits of this serial killer story sort of poking up, but it's not the A story. Solve the problem or the mystery with the A story. And at the end, we remind the reader about that serial killer, which becomes the A story in the next book.
Sure.
But what I think new writers and all writers that write this kind of book should do is keep that in mind on every chapter. You really have to get your, you do not want, in this day and age with games and social media and all that, if you write more than one paragraph that's not interesting, that's not needed for the story, they'll just put the book away. Now, some chapters or some paragraphs are not going to be, you know, high intensity, compelling, but they do need to move the character forward. They do need to move the story forward. So I would just say, look at what interests you in other way other books are written. And then think about it like a movie or a TV series, a bingeable TV series. What makes you as a watcher keep watching, even though it's 1 o'clock in the morning and you got to get up at 6, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Now, Tom Clancy, how did you wind up writing in that campus, in that universe?
Yeah, so Mark Graney, the guy who the movie The Gray Man, he writes a wonderful series called The Gray Man. And then the movie that came out last year is based on that. But he was writing them, and we had become friends over the years at Thriller Fest and VoucherCon. And one day, I think we were in New Orleans, and he just said, "Hey, what you working on now?" And I told him I was writing another Jericho book and getting ready to start another series. And he said, "Well, let me see that Jericho book. I'll give you a cover blurb." Didn't mention anything about the Clancys at all.
Yeah.
And then about 3 months later, my wife and I were in Florida doing some research for the New Orleans Cutter. And I got a call from Robin, my agent. She said, "Hey, Mark Graney has decided to step away from the Clancys to work on his own stuff full time. He's done 7 already. And he's recommended you." So in the meantime, after getting my stuff, he had sent the manuscript to Tom Colgan, the editor at Putnam, who edited Tom Clancy. I mean, he's been with the Clancy estate in the Clancy universe for a long time. And Tom hired me, and the estate, you know, signed off on it. And I've done the last 6, and then I'm kind of in the same boat that Mark was, writing my 7th. And I've told them that that's going to be good for me. It was a great honor. And it's been wonderful to write these characters that I love, but it's not something I sought out. It's something they approached me with, and I'm glad I did it. But there comes a time when I really need to focus on my own work and give someone else a chance to explore these characters, because they are someone else's characters. And I've kind of written, I'm writing the very last one in my effort now. In fact, as soon as we're off this, I have to go do a little research on it. So it's been a great honor, but this will be my last one. And Andrews and Wilson, the writing team, have already announced that they're going to be taking over, and they do the tier 1 novels, great writers. And I think they'll do some interesting stuff. My Clancy's, because I don't have a military background, I have a lot of military friends, but my expertise is in, you know, federal law enforcement, sure, protection, and a bit of espionage and things like that. And so I tend to make mine spy books with a military set piece, where they have military backgrounds. And so I'm interested to see how they write.
Right. So let me ask you this. What was your favorite part about writing the Tom Clancy books?
Writing John Clark. There's a character that people that are Clancy fans would know, that he was the main character in Without Remorse. I'm not talking about the show. I'm talking about the books, because they are a little different. In the books, his girlfriend gets murdered brutally by these drug people, and he's a very young, kind of messed up former Navy SEAL, and he goes on the rampage to get these, get revenge on these drug dealers in Baltimore. And it's one of the favorite Clancy canon for a lot of Clancy folks. And so writing him as an older man, since I'm an older man now, and writing him as a you know, I do get emails periodically saying, Clark's got to be 70 years old. How could he be doing this stuff? Well, I make him pay for it. But I always refer people back to Billy Wall. And look at what he's done. He's 90 something now, but he went in, Billy Wall went to Afghanistan when he was 70 something with Jawbreaker in the first in. So it is possible. And people that know John Clark, he is a cool dude. And he's always been I've always been a fan of his, as well as Jack Ryan and Dean Chavez and Mary Pat Foley. So it's just been such a cool honor to be able to look at these Clancy characters and say, huh, what can I have John Clark up to now? So really, I get paid very well to write fan fiction is what I'm in the spirit of Tom Clancy.
Okay. We're probably going to start winding this down here a little bit.
Certainly.
You know, I had the pleasure of meeting you and your wife at 20 Books in Vegas last November, and that was a kick for me. You know, it's, you make friends doing, you know, podcasts and being in these circles, but nothing is as good as meeting the person, you know, face to face.
No, I agree. And it was great to see you.
And one thing that I noticed about you is I don't think you ever turn off your writer's brain, you know, because we were having conversations or whatever, and you're like, hey, that would be good in a story. You know, I think that would be really, and I'm thinking to myself, and I'm looking at you, and I'm like, that brain is in overdrive, it seems like, all the time with that. Was I right in picking up on that, or?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think that's when I said earlier that I wanted to write books that made people read them because I was a writer, not because I was a former cop. We do use that to market. I'll be honest. We talk about my background because in this day and age, you need to sell that and let people know that you do have some gravitas when it comes to that. But I, from the time I was a kid, I just believed in being observant. I just watch people and I've taken notes. And if somebody says something, you know, I can't remember who said this. And ironically, this is the quote, writers remember everything they hear and then forget where they said it so they can take the credit, right? And so we're just constantly, I've always described writing or writers as being like mollusks. We're like these filter feeders in the world, like an oyster, a clam or whatever. And we're just filtering out the good stuff and put it into books. So you could find pretty much any plot or dialogue or, you know, they say, it's kind of a rote trope, I guess, that it's all been said before. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. But as a writer, what we're doing is we're looking for that little interesting tidbit that I saw that, hey, they might be interested in that as well, but they weren't there to see it. So I'm going to put it in a book, or the way somebody says something. And being in law enforcement did benefit me. Lots of jobs would do this, but you know from personal experience, Patrick, that you are with people in some of their darkest moments.
Oh yeah.
And so when you observe people, when they're under stress, some people crumble and some people rise to the occasion with such valor. And I'm not talking about just police, citizens, any humans rise to those occasions. And I try to take note of that and then, you know, really celebrate that in the books and also take note of how vile human beings can be towards each other.
Absolutely.
And just write that down. And absolutely, my writer's brain is, I had a big meeting in DC before I retired, and everybody knew I wrote by then and I was getting ready to retire, but they also knew that I had a little book that I carried around all the time, because if somebody said something cool or I observed something, I would write it down in my little book. And I, in my bookcase back here, I probably got 30 of them, the little Moleskine notebooks, kind of like the ones that Craig gave out at. But a little tiny bit smaller. So I was in DC, I was the deputy director of the Marshal Service. There was a bunch of other chief deputies like me and a marshal, presidentially appointed marshal, and some people from Maine Justice. So associate attorney general, stuff like that. And some of them had brought books for me to sign. They read my Jericho.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And so we're talking, then we get on to business and we're talking about whatever, I can't remember what working group it was, something about staffing. And so we were talking about staffing and stuff, all that. And one of these guys from one of the uppity ups said something really funny, and everybody laughed and I laughed. And then everybody just kind of stopped and looked at me. And the guy from Justice goes, "What the hell? That was a good line. You need to write that in your
book.
You should
write that down."
So they were kind of miffed that he didn't make the book. But yeah. So I'm, you know, I think most writers are that way. They're always on.
Today's show is sponsored by Ingram Spark. You've finished your manuscript and you're ready to self-publish your book. But how? Whether you want to publish a hardcover, paperback, ebook, or all three, you can print your book and sell it locally and globally to physical stores, online retailers, and libraries.
Ingram Spark can help you publish your book and reach a world of readers. Simply create an Ingram Spark account and enjoy incredible features, including a free book building tool, publishing guides, custom trim sizes, and access to one of the largest global book distribution networks. Your books are delivered to retailers, direct to customers, or your front door as they're ordered. Visit IngramSpark.com and start publishing today.
So if you guys could get access to any person, place, or thing for research, just hypothetically, what would it be? What would your like dream thing for that be?
Oh, that's easy. I want to see where Walt Disney is frozen. So apparently he's on ice somewhere below that castle, and I've never seen it. I've been in the tunnels underneath Disney World before, which is kind of neat. A lot of people haven't seen those.
But that's cool.
My sister, one of her best friends, she was a dancer at Disney for years, and she used to take us through those tunnels. And like, you can get from one end of the park to the other in like no time. There's golf carts down there that employees can just grab, just zip around and stuff. And I think Brad Meltzer actually wrote a book at one point where he used those as an integral part of the story, which is kind of neat. But yeah, Disney's frozen body. I think I want to see that.
I want to be in the Vatican. I want to go into the locked archives of the Vatican.
That would be very cool.
That's cool.
Dan Brown style.
I would be willing to reach my maximum yearly dose of radiation to go with a biologist to Chernobyl for just a little bit.
Holiday in Chernobyl with JP.
I want to see what's in Area 51. Let's go.
Area 51. Yeah.
Is there really stuff in Area 51? Come on.
Nah, they keep it somewhere else. That's why they publicize it.
I think that's a shadow play.
That's why they publicize it. Yes. I want to see the real Area
exactly.
51.
I think Chernobyl is a tourist trap at this point. Don't they have tours and stuff you can go on to?
I would like to like shadow a biologist who's doing research in relation between radioactivity and the animals in that area.
Really,
all right, so I'll shadow you 1 year later if you still have all your hair.
Yeah, I was just gonna say you go first.
You'll be shadowing him, all right, because he's gonna be emitting a glow.
I have worked in facilities where I've had to wear.
Do you have your own
background? That's not a selling point in the interview.
You know, just be careful.
I'd go to Chernobyl, but I'm picking up every spider I can find.
Used one.
I'm going to let every spider on that island bite me.
I really like the story of when he was a rookie cop in a small town in Texas, and he was also a rookie writer, and he got one of his first royalty checks. It was a big one for back then. It was like $700. And his wife is like, "Well, that's nice. Why don't you go write us a new couch or refrigerator? We need this. You know, we need this stuff. Go write us, you know, this thing." For you guys, what was one of the best writer's present to yourself that you ever got? That's physical that you could see. It's like, "Hey, I wrote this book, or I made this much money on X, Y, and Z, and there's the car in the driveway to prove it." Or the blender, or the coffee maker, whatever, you know, whatever the case may be.
The blender. I bought a car. I bought a Dodge Challenger when I got. I forget which film deal it was. I think it was for Dracul. But yeah, the money came in, and like up until that point, like I hadn't been spending it other than my wife and I put a lot of it into real estate. But you know, it was basically practical spends. We put money in the stock market. We put money away for this. We put money away for daughter's college funds, all these types of things. But like, that was the first real, I'm just buying something for myself. Pick thing that I got.
When we started getting serious money for the collar books, we bought a $170,000 van and lived in it for 2 or 3 years and travel.
Did you have like your book cover on the side of the van? That would be kind of cool.
I need bigger checks, obviously. I put some money back into marketing and like cover for the next book. I don't know.
Well, see, that's kind of how, like, before that, that's what I was doing too. You know, like you take the money that comes in, you put it back into that. There's, you know, very little left over or whatever. So when you actually do start getting bigger paydays, like you still have that mindset. It's really difficult. Like that was a very hard check for me to write because it just felt like, you know, it was a little shy of like $30,000. It wasn't even an expensive car really. But you know, when you look at that and you're like, that's X number of Facebook ads. That's, you know, this can cover my electric bill for, you know, this number of payments. And yeah, so it takes a little while to make that mindset. But I think when you do that too, it makes you mentally, like, I felt like I had taken it to another level, you know, and it just kept kind of going after that. So I think it helps. And you got to reward yourself, you know, you're working your butt off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
So Mark's wife and him are a team. She was an English teacher, and she's the first person that sees his books when he's done writing a book. She's his proofreader, and she doesn't pull punches. You know, she tells him exactly. It's like, okay, you need to do this, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Do you guys, well, let me rephrase this. Would you want like a significant other or somebody that you're close to doing that or not? Or do you do that now?
I think I've talked about this before, but my wife is my alpha reader. She's the first, I give her the first chapter, and she tells me whether or not the story is worth pursuing. Then I write the whole book, and, you know, when the book is finished, you know, and leaves my desk, she's the first person to tear it apart. It took a little while for her to get to that. Like when she did it with the first one, she was, you know, very, you know, guarded as far as what she would tell me, but she does not hold punches anymore. And I appreciate that, you know, so a lot of the authors I know, I mean, it's probably maybe 70 to 80% of them, I think, have that one person in their life that does that for them. But a couple of them don't, you know, like Dean Koontz, for example. I don't think his wife reads any of his books. They go straight off to his editor when they're done. You know, sometimes that's a little smoother around the household.
Yeah. I torture my husband with my books, and he doesn't read the genres that I write typically, but I make him read it anyway. And so I actually think it's good that he doesn't read the genres that I write, because he will tell me exactly what he thinks. And I do appreciate that. But yeah. Our marriage is intact still, so we're good.
Kara does not read my books anymore. She read the first like five or six, and, you know, after that she got tired of, she was never getting to read her own stuff. So, you know, she holds off. Now she says she's going to come back around, but hey, it's been more than a decade, so I don't think that's happening.
If I waited for my partner to read anything I wrote, I would still be stuck on my first short story. So that's a hard no.
Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. So, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Josh Malerman coming back, New York Times bestselling author of Bird Box and many others. He's here to tell us about his latest short story collection called Spin a Black Yarn, which releases August 15th.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.